Welcome to the Lost Ways of Knowing podcast. Your host is Matthew Krepps, religious scholar, philosopher, and co-founder of Circle Yoga Shala. The Lost Ways of Knowing teaches a basic history of the Indian traditions that are central to modern yoga. If you're a yoga teacher or practitioner, you must listen for a clear, concise, and provocative engagement with how this history might apply to today's world. The ultimate aim of this podcast is to initiate a dialogue about awakening and overcoming self-deception, leading to deeper intimacy with what is real. Matthew's coming to you from his home, Circle Yoga Shala, which is also a working farm and yoga teacher, yoga therapy training facility.
Welcome, everyone. So you'll recall that in this season of the podcast, we've been trying to speak directly about enlightenment or the idea of liberation as something central in the yoga traditions. And we've talked about it as a kind of qualitative transformation of the individual, something that surpasses mere psychological modification and pushes into the transformation of our deepest sense of value, our deepest sense of identity. And so we want to characterize it as something that is a transformation beyond the level of the personality. And in the last episode, we discussed contemporary definitions of enlightenment. And so we brought commentary from recent teachers who have all been very influential on the Shala. In this episode, we want to circle back to the traditions from the first several seasons and really briefly try to speak about liberation from their perspective. And we do this in part to keep noting that though you can make the statement that yoga, broadly speaking, is about liberation, there is no single vision of what it means to reach that goal. In this episode, we want to focus briefly on the early and the late Vedic periods. Then we'll continue on with a few more episodes that concern things like the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, the Bhagavad Gita, and then broadly speaking, those Siddha yoga traditions, which include Hatha Yoga and Tantra. Now, if we start with the Vedic revelation, it's important to remember that the Vedas are loosely divided into two parts. The early Veda is primarily concerned with ritual, and it is this part that's often referred to as the Mimamsaka. And so Mimamsakas are the Vedic ritualists whose purpose is to officiate in the enactment of the Vedic sacrifice and also to engage in philosophical discussion that defends the Vedic sacrifice as the proper way to address the existential crises that we face in life, and therefore to realize the meaning and purpose that is available to us. The later part of the Veda is most often referred to as Vedanta. And we see this in that sublime body of literature called the Upanishads. And in the Upanishad, as we saw in the first several seasons, this notion that we have to make a sacrifice is internalized. inside the individual practitioner. And that internalization inaugurates the quest for Brahman, or the ultimate source of being, in an attempt to realize the proper relationship between the human soul, or the Atman, and the source, or what we would call God. Now, the early Veda, the Mimamsaka, is also called the time of the Samhitas. Well, this is the Rig Veda, the Sama Veda, the Yajur Veda, and the Atharva Veda. And in this body of literature, there's not really a clear concept of escaping the birth and death cycle, or liberation as it comes to be spoken of in not only the yoga traditions that follow, like the Upanishad, but also by the Buddha. What we see in the Samhitas, or the early Veda, is an idea of living virtuously by performing the sacrificial rituals that are prescribed in a timely and careful manner. And this ensures several things, but the main thing in this context is one is hoping not to be reborn in a lower station in life. One is hoping to be reborn, hopefully, at a higher station. And there are very subtle levels, rarefied levels, in which one can be born. I should mention that some scholars insist that there's not even a coherent concept of rebirth in this literature, and so it's kind of unclear. But in general, the teachers that I have been with and the things that I have studied do suggest that there's an idea of the birth and death cycle, but there's no real idea of escaping it as a kind of instantiation of being liberated. Now, the Mimamsa Sutra is the expression of the philosophy that supports the existence of the Vedic sacrifice and its continued performance. So in the Mimamsa Sutra, the goal of life is to act in the world according to what the Veda refers to as the Dharma. So we want to participate in the sacrificial rituals in a good way so that the boons, or the rewards that they confer, can be ours. And these rewards could be rain for the crops, or healthy crops in general, or knowledge about the present or about the future, or, as I mentioned, a better birth in the next life. It's important to note here that later in the Bhagavad Gita, this way of performing the sacrifice, or this way of living according to the Dharma, is called the path of action. And so Dharma is an interesting word. It can be translated as kind of like law, or duty, or virtue, or action, which is kind of a common theme in all of those iterations that I mentioned. So to give you a sense of this, let me read you something from the Mimamsa Sutra on the nature of action. Quote, according to some, the Vedas deal with the problem of the soul as their principal subject matter. But this is not correct, because we find that they deal with the world of nature, which is not permanent. This has been stated to be their subject matter, and that is how they are taught and explained. And all Vedic literature is of the same kind. As they deal with the problem of action, they tell us what actions to perform and how to perform them. And so, from this most ancient perspective, we're in this place, we need to behave in a way that is not destructive, in a way that is virtuous, in a way that is cooperative with the laws of the universe, so that we maintain ourselves in good standing. And the sacrifice, or the way of action, is the way to accomplish this. Now, in the later Veda, which is expressed in the Upanishad and referred to as Vedanta, we begin to see ideas of liberation as escape from the birth and death cycle. And so the Upanishad is in a sense a rejection of the formal externalized Vedic sacrifice. And that sacrifice gets internalized and becomes a kind of contemplative practice. And now we're looking to realize the relationship between the soul and the source, and thereby free ourselves from any liability for rebirth. Here's a quote from Dr. Keith Ward, an English scholar who is an interesting man. He's a Christian theologian, but also someone who is very conversant with the Indian traditions and their ideas of liberation and what that means. Dr. Ward says, "It is important to see that Vedanta takes its stand on the supreme authority of Scripture, not on human reasoning. The Scripture in question is the Veda, which is taken to include not only the four main collections known as the Samhitas, but also and mainly the Upanishads, which were added later. The Bhagavad Gita itself is considered to be an Upanishad, and all of these scriptures, which are divine revelations," remember this is what is important here, "are interpreted and read in different ways by different teachers." Now, this is a complex subject, and I'm obviously just speaking about it in the time we have to give you a sense of the diversity of what Vedanta means. This was a very important moment in my life as a yoga teacher and a student of these things, to see that when I began to read the Upanishads and to encounter Vedanta, I encountered an interpretation that comes from one of the three heavyweight teachers that I'm going to mention. And so I was really amazed to see the diversity, and this helped me really understand how the idea of liberation has nuance within one quote-unquote tradition called Vedanta. So the three major players are Shankaracharya, Ramanujacharya, and Madhvacharya. Those of us in the West, whether we know it or not, are generally influenced by Shankaracharya. Shankara is said to have lived sometime between 788 and 820, and he was from Kerala. He was a Shaiva philosopher, and this means a follower of Shiva. And he's an exponent of what is called pure non-dualism, or Advaita Vedanta. Advaita is a Sanskrit word, I believe, that means not to. And then we have Ramanujacharya, who lived between 1056 and 1137. And he is from the Tamil country. And Ramanuja is a Vaishnavite. That means a follower of Vishnu, and a lover of Krishna. And he reads the Vedanta literature as a philosopher of what has come to be called qualified non-dualism, or Vishishtadvaita Vedanta. And then we have Madhvacharya from 1238 to 1317 from the area of Karnataka. And he also, like Ramanuja, is a Vaishnavite. But he is an exponent of something called pure dualistic Vedanta, or Dvaita Vedanta. So it's important to remember that each of these great thinkers is reading the texts of the Upanishads and of the Bhagavad Gita, and that they are arriving at subtly different conclusions. Now let's go into each of them individually and see if we can make sense of what liberation means for each of them, and then try to sum up a little bit about the significance of those differences for how we ourselves kind of think about what it might mean to be liberated. Let's start with Shankara and Advaita, or non-dual Vedanta. Shankara is one of the greatest commentators in the Vedanta school. And this idea of non-dual Vedanta has often been characterized as a position of monism. And so not two has often been taken as the idea that everything is ultimately one. Now, this idea of oneness, in a strong interpretation of Shankara, is the idea that the soul, or the Atman, which is the word we find in the Upanishads, for that's usually translated as soul, is taken to be identical in substance with Brahman. And so we often hear the phrase, Atman is Brahman. And for Shankara, this is really important. It sets up a kind of epistemological conundrum, because this absolute sameness between the soul and God makes it difficult to explain our perceptions of differences between things in the world. And on this strong reading of Shankara as a monist, any perception of difference in the world or in oneself and other things, between oneself and other things, is an illusion. And this is the word, or the teaching, of Maya, which is translated sometimes as illusion and sometimes as veil, like a covering over the truth. And Shankara takes any perception of difference to be the product of ignorance or avidya. I have a quotation here from Dr. Wendy Doniger about this idea of Maya and our perceptions of difference. Quote, that the phenomenal world of everyday experience and its biological round of birth and death was ultimately unreal, and the source of our bondage was taken as the basis for a monastic or ascetic life of renunciation. And so Shankara's ideas tend to be characterized as ascetic. And that idea of ascesis is an idea of control of the senses, an idea of strong renunciation of the common things in life, a kind of pulling back from the world. And this move of pulling back away from the world is necessary for someone who believes that perception is a veil that subtly hides the truth of who I am and keeps me in ignorance. And so this ascetic move is a key to understanding what awakening is for Shankara. So, because any perception of separateness, and the main perception of separateness we're concerned with here is the perception of difference between the soul and its source, since any perception like that is arising from avidya and is ultimately an illusion, the identity of soul with the source is realized when the soul, quote, casts off its individuality and personal characteristics and becomes the simple, eternal self. And so Shankara's idea of awakening is inherently tied to this idea of casting off the illusion of individuality, which leaves only the pure self, which is one and the same in all things. Dr. Keith Ward says, the desiring agent and enjoyer, which we commonly call the self, has to be transcended and cast aside by ascetic discipline and meditation. So this idea of the sense of individuality, which is equated with the sense of separateness here, which is an illusion, has often produced a metaphor to try and describe what liberation means in this context of strong Advaita Vedanta. And that metaphor is the metaphor of a drop of water, or sometimes a grain of salt, being dissolved in the great ocean of bliss. And so from this perspective, if I am a little bit cheeky in my description, heaven is going to be really, really great because I'm not going to be there. Because in this idea, I am an illusory sense of separateness that produces endless desires that will never ultimately be fulfilled because they're based on an illusion. And once I am free of that, once I realize who it is that I actually am, I'll no longer be subject to those desires and the actions that ensue from them, and I will be free from this round of birth and death.
Looking for a yoga teacher training that goes beyond poses? At Circle Yoga Shala, our 200 and 300-hour programs are immersive journeys into somatic awareness, spiritual depth, and authentic teaching. Rooted in ancient wisdom and modern insight, these trainings are designed to transform your practice and your life. Learn more and apply at CircleYogaShala.com, where yoga isn't performance, it's presence.
Now, if we move to Ramanuja, we have an interesting amendment or subtle revaluation of Shankara's ideas. So Ramanuja has something in common with Shankara and also something that separates him from Shankara's view. This is called Vishishtadvaita, and that means qualified non-dualism. And so there's an element of oneness here, but that element of oneness doesn't subsume the whole picture. So what does that mean? Ramanuja holds that there is indeed only one true divine source, which is Brahman. And the soul, the individual soul, is non-separate from this source. In particular, the soul shares in the divine essence, which is called bliss or ananda. However, there are apparent differences between the individual souls and God, and those are real. And so the existence of the soul itself is dependent on God. The soul is like God in essence and unlike God in expression, so to speak. And both of these are true. So we see a qualified non-dualism. There's an idea of sameness of essence or a monism of essence and a plurality of real phenomenon and manifestation. The universal sameness in essence makes unification with God something where the bliss of God can be realized for us, but the realization of that will not destroy or eradicate our inherent individuality. Importantly here, Ramanuja conceives of the source as a person, something like us. I have a quote here that will give you a sense of his beautiful conception of God. He says, quote, "We know from Scripture that there is a supreme person whose nature is absolute bliss and goodness, who is fundamentally antagonistic to all evil, who is the cause of the origination, sustenance, and dissolution of the world, who differs in nature from all other beings, who is all-knowing, who by his mere will and thought accomplishes all his purposes, who is an ocean of kindness, as it were, for all who depend on him, who is all-merciful, who is immeasurably raised above the possibility of anyone being equal or superior to him, whose name is the highest Brahman." And so we see here an attempt to formulate this oneness of essence, but reality of difference. And we can experience our oneness of essence with the source in relationship. And that relationship shows the qualities of bliss and mercy and kindness. But we are not equal or superior to the source. We are dependent for our existence on that source. This idea that the source is maybe not totally personal, but because the source is ultimately transcendent and the ground of all things, that the source does express as a person in relationships of mercy and so on, is really important, because Shankara's objections to Ramanuja's strong non-dualism hinge around this notion of being able to have a relationship with the source. If you are a qualified non-dualist, the teaching of Maya is unnecessary and false. The world is not an illusion, it is real. And the perceived differences between the soul and Brahman are actually the foundation then for true worship. When Ramanuja critiqued Shankara, he reasoned that if everything is ultimately one, then the distinctions between the source and the soul, i.e. between God and his devotees, those distinctions are erased. They are illusions. And this in turn makes a mockery of worship and ritual action, which is actually founded on real differences, or what you might call a real relationship. So if the devotee and God are actually one, then worship is ultimately God praying and offering to himself. And for Ramanuja, this is an inherent devaluation of love, because true love is an exchange between two who are real and different from one another and who come together in a unique relationship. We might call it a face-to-face meeting. When Wendy Doniger is trying to make clear for us the differences between Ramanuja and Shankara's strong non-dualism, she says, quote, "Shankara's non-dualism has the disadvantage that you cannot love God or worship God if you are God, or if your God is without qualities." And so really, for someone who is looking to turn to the source, not only for guidance and not only for love, but also for comfort and for mercy, the differences between me and the source need to be real, because otherwise true love is not possible. And love for Ramanuja, as well as for Madhava, as we're about to see, is really the purpose of all existence and the sign that liberation has been realized. So when do I know, so to speak, that I have escaped the round of birth and death? It's when a certain love has been realized in this life. Now let's finish up with Madhvacharya. So Madhva is an exponent of what is called Dvaita Vedanta. And that means dualistic Vedanta. And a way to make this clear is to recall everything that we have said about the Sankhya philosophy, which is generally considered a dualistic cosmological plan of the universe. And that means in Sankhya, if you'll remember, there is a pair of eternal realities. One is Purusha, pure consciousness, or awareness, or light. And then Prakriti, which is the stuff that nature is made out of, all bodies are made out of. And this metaphysical idea is inherent in Madhva's system. Well, that means that the metaphysical reality, the nature of reality itself, is plural. It's not monistic. There's not just one thing. There are primarily two categories of reality. This means that for Madhva, reality is plural. And that means it's not composed of one substance. It's not monistic in its essence. And Madhva lays out this plurality as reality is made of svatantra tattva, which means independent reality, and asvatantra tattva, which means dependent reality. Now, the independent reality is Ishvara, and that means God as Vishnu or as Krishna in this case, because he's a Vaishnavite. And Ishvara is the independent reality, which is the cause of the universe. God is the only thing that is independent or uncaused, whose existence doesn't depend on anything else. By contrast, the created universe is the dependent reality, consisting of the jiva, and that is the individual soul, and the jada, which is the matter or the material of all things and the material things that exist. Now, importantly, Individual souls themselves are plural. This means they are different and distinct realities. The jivas, which are the individual souls, are sentient. That means they know and feel and sense and think. And matter is non-sentient. It does not know. It does not feel. It does not think. So Madhava really is the philosopher of differences. He's obviously in the camp where the differences between things are not only real, but these differences are really, really important. And so he enumerates the difference between dependent and independent reality in a five-fold structure that is generally showing the differences between God and souls and material things. So specifically, these differences are, one, there are differences between material things. There are differences between material things and the soul. There are differences between material things and God. There are differences between individual souls. And there are differences between the soul and God. This is the pancha veda, the doctrine of differences. Well, this means that for Madhava, there is no object like any other object. There is no soul like any other soul. All souls are unique, and that uniqueness is reflected in individual personalities. There's a saying that Madhava would often teach to illustrate the importance of this difference. Quote, the sea is full, the tank is full, the pot is full, everything is full, yet each fullness is different. And so here, we are sort of on the other end of the spectrum that we started on with Shankara. What's real here is the differences between the fullness. We see that there is a concept of fullness. This itself can be misleading, almost as if the concept of fullness is an illusion. And what's real is the differences between those fullnesses, the differences in their shape, the differences in their quantity, and so on and so on and so on. And so here, the difference between the soul and God is real. And so Madhava doesn't really want to entertain a sameness of essence in the way that Ramanuja did. He wants uniqueness, the uniqueness of the soul, to be contrasted over and against the uniqueness of God. What does liberation mean in this context? So according to Madhvacharya, in liberation, there is a bliss that is attained, and that bliss has to do with being unified with God in a certain way. But the nature of this bliss is different for each person, based on each person's degree of knowledge and spiritual perfection. And more than this, there isn't any real effort that individual souls or people can make that will achieve this unification with God. Bliss is only able to be realized through God's grace, which is Vishnu. Madhvacharya considered the yoga of knowledge, Jnana Yoga, or the yoga of realization or renunciation, and the yoga of Karma Yoga, that is the yoga of action, which is deeply related to the Vedic ritual here. He considered both of those to be insufficient without bhakti. And so devotion is the key. Devotion is the beckoning of the individual to the grace of God for salvation. But when liberation is achieved for Madhva, the bliss of divine love is felt, but that bliss of divine love is different for each person. And the differences between each person or each soul are going to be maintained after the advent of being freed from the birth and death cycle. So we're not going to lose our individuality. Madhva and Ramana just share that in particular. But Madhva's conception emphasizes difference even more than Ramanuja. So let's make a summary. We noted that in the early Veda, there is no clear concept of liberation as it comes to be known in the later traditions. And we also noted that some scholars argue that there's no clear expression even of the birth and death cycle of reincarnation there. Nonetheless, what is advised is adherence to ritual sacrifice, which is known as following the Dharma in a life of virtuous action in the hopes that everything will go well, we'll have the knowledge that we need. And in the case that there is an idea of rebirth, that we won't be reborn in a situation that's worse than the one we find ourselves in. Hopefully, we'll be reborn in a better situation. In later Vedanta, we noted three main interpretations of the idea of what it means to be liberated from birth and death. In the non-dualistic traditions, this involves the overcoming of all sense of separateness and entails the idea that when this happens, the personal sense of self dissolves like a drop of water or a grain of salt into the ocean of bliss. So there is no more unique individuality, no more sense of separateness when this happens. So it's a kind of ultimate unity. And then we saw that Ramanuja has the idea that we can realize a shared sense of bliss with God, and that in this shared sense of bliss, individual difference will be preserved to some extent, while also the bliss that is attained in this idea of liberation is very strong and similar for each soul within an individual sense. And so that's made possible because in essence, we are one or non-separate from the source, but our differences are real. And so we won't dissolve. We will be maintained in our individuality. At the same time, we'll be unified in the bliss that we feel because of our natural or ontological connection to the source. And then finally, we come to the philosopher of real ontological difference in Madhva. And there is a chance to realize freedom from the birth and death cycle here, and the realization of that freedom is a love relationship or a bliss relationship of being unified with God. The difference here is that the degree of bliss we feel or the quality of bliss we feel is different based on each individual nature, based on the spiritual attainment of each individual and the quality of the individual's knowledge. So not only is difference maintained, not only does the individual not disappear in the event of liberation here, but the experience of liberation itself is well defined and different for each person. Even though all of those experiences of liberation are experiences of divine love, there's a subtle uniqueness to each of them that will be maintained in an eternity of freedom as I stay or am united with God. And so these ideas are really fascinating. When I teach them to students, I see that there is often a kind of mishmash of all of them to some degree. It's important to remember that in what we generally call the West, we are a strongly individualistic culture. And so we tend to think of or identify with the personality and with personal psychological content as if that were the source of our being. This really is a result of the loss of the concept of something like soul in the secular world, and trying to put in that empty space of the soul something like psychology. And so we all really emphasize our individuality, and we think that what it means to be free is to be able to express individuality apart from any external constraint. And at the same time, people generally think of yoga as unity, and they just assume that unity would be a really great thing. But we see here that in the case of Shankara, there is a kind of unity that destroys any sense of separateness. And that kind of unity is attractive, right, to some people. It sounds a lot like Buddhism in a sense, and it's not surprising that Ramanuja often is said to have accused Shankara's teaching of being crypto-Buddhist, because the Buddhist is the teacher of anatman, or the teacher of no self, and therefore the teacher that is dismissive of personality and at the ultimate scale. And so if you have that idea of unity, there's a way of reading the Vedanta through Shankara's eyes, which will satisfy you. But if you have an idea that, no, there is something very important about my uniqueness, if you are affected, for instance, by disciplines like Ayurveda, which is the discipline of individual uniqueness and the application of herbal theory and pranayama and devotional strategies and meditation in ways that try to take into account individual uniqueness, then this monistic idea of unity begins to be a little bit unsettling, because I always thought that if I was liberated, I would still be there in heaven. I can't imagine being changed into something, or something that didn't recognize individuality or recognize the others with whom I cherish my relations. I couldn't imagine that as being part of what it means to be free. So Ramanuja and Madhava really hold down that end of the idea, where the individual soul will not be erased, or it will not dissolve, and it will remain in a relationship. And this makes possible a kind of love that is very familiar to us and something that we all yearn for. So I really hope this has been interesting, and I hope it gets you to thinking about how you think about ideas like unity and freedom and the individual and the community and love and so on. And so next time we'll come back again with some more traditional definitions of liberation from things like the Yoga Sutra and the Bhagavad Gita. So God bless you all. Thanks for listening. And we hope to see you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Lost Ways of Knowing podcast. We hope it was informative and also inspiring for you. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcast and leave a review for us so other yoga teachers and practitioners can find us. For in-person opportunities to learn and grow in a community setting, visit CircleYogaShala.com.